Sheffield Live. Made in Sheffield, made by you.
If you like rock in all its forms, you will love Glory Days. You can listen to us locally on 93.2 FM and on the telly, and anywhere in the world on sheffieldlive.org. What do you think, Don? You know what? I think he likes it. That's Glory Days, every Monday 1 till 3 here on Sheffield Live. Bosh, bosh. Oops, I've had an accident.
Hello, I'm Harry Wilburn. I present Steel & Wire every Wednesday, 10 a.m. Americana, bluegrass, American roots, and more. Lots more. Lots of guests, lots of local music and musicians. That's Steel & Wire, Wednesday, 10 a.m.
You're listening to fabulous Harry Wilburn on Steel & Wire.
It's time to open the music box. Join me, Steve Roden, every Thursday morning between 10 and 12 for music from the 40s to the 90s from my own music collection. Songs I've grown up with, ones I am sure you will enjoy hearing again. Hope to see you then.
If you love new music and you want to discover the best new artists out there, then tune into The Backroom with me, Paddy. I'll be playing the best in new indie, electro, EDM and punk and showcasing new Sheffield talent. Also music news, local and national gig guide and new album releases. So tune into The Backroom every Thursday night between 6 and 7 p.m. here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM.
This is Sheffield Live.
N-E-X-T.
Good morning. Welcome to the Live Sounds Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire or sheffieldlive.org. You can listen online there. You can also download the podcast later and listen at your leisure. This show is all about science in all its different forms, and we play some rather cool music as well. You've got Julian Pauly live in the studio as usual. We'll be talking to RPG later on in this hour as well. And we've also got our guest speaker for this week, and indeed every fourth Saturday of the month. It's Chris Dale. He's going to be talking about Forever Chemicals. All good stuff. All being well, next week, and indeed every first Saturday of the month, our guest speaker is Phil Muffett from the Mexburn Swinton Astronomical Society. And talking of which, they have an event tonight. It's called Planets in the Park. It's tonight, Saturday the 28th of February, just in case you are listening on catch up. It starts at 6 o'clock this evening and lasts until about 8:30 this evening. It's going to be an evening of stargazing and planet watching at Clifton Park Garden House and Courtyard in Rotherham. That's S65 2AA. It's a free event. No booking is required, and it's suitable for all ages. There'll also be presentations and displays to complement observing of the night sky. And if you do have a telescope and require advice, please bring it along. Do wrap up warm for the evening. Refreshments will be available for a small charge. You can check out their website, www.msas.org.uk. Good luck with the weather tonight, I'm hoping for them, because as with all astronomical events and viewing things like this, the weather can be a bit of a problem, but there will be lots of other things to do besides all good stuff. Also, another reminder, you can also check out smartphonefreechildhood.org online. You could sign the Parent Pact online and join parents in your area who are delaying smartphones and social media. Last week, if you tuned in, you would have heard Gareth Morgan do a talk. He's from the Sheffield Photographic Society. And just a reminder that their annual exhibition for 2026 will be at Sheffield Cathedral from Friday the 20th of March until Monday the 30th of March. It's a fantastic exhibition, so do check it out. Put it in your diary. Before we move on then, in the science news this week,
Yes. More than 40,000 years ago, Europeans were carving lines, dots, crosses, and neatly spaced notches into small ivory sculptures. A study suggests these marks, along some assumed to have been decorative, were not simply a means of passing along Ice Age evenings. Instead, they may have been a system for storing information devised more than 35,000 years before the appearance of the first writing. The research led by Christian Bentz, a linguist at Saarland University, and Ewa Dutkiewicz, an archaeologist at the Museum for Pre- and Early History in Berlin, analysed more than 3,000 marks carved into about 260 objects dating from 30,000 to 40,000 years ago. Next, the cost of the Hinkley Point C nuclear power station, the first nuclear power plant in a generation, has ballooned to nearly $50 billion, and the date when it expected to be in service has been put back to 2030. It was originally meant to cost $15 billion and should have already been operating by now. And Space Solar, a startup based in Didcot, Oxfordshire, has outlined plans to put its first solar panels in space by 2028. The company hopes to install 15 gigawatts of space-based solar power by 2040. Meanwhile, the Ashmolean Museum, also in Oxford, which owes its existence to two obsessive gardeners who set out to collect the world, John Tradescant the Elder, has curated an expansive exhibition in bloom, which traces the journey that some of Britain's most familiar blooms travelled to get here, and the impact they had when they did so. The In Bloom exhibition, which opens on 19th of March, also explores the visual traditions that shaped how plants were recorded and understood, featuring paintings, drawings and prints by some of the world's greatest botanical artists, showing how illustrators became essential to identifying, investigating and celebrating these species.
And a very interesting article I think Chris might be interested in. I saw in the paper the other day, Fermenting a Revolution with Liquid Bread. So over the decades, in several Eastern European countries, large yellow barrels have become a common sight on street corners. In summer, people can be seen queuing up for a cup of something that looks like porter, or to fill large bottles and even buckets to take home. The queues are for a thousand-year-old drink called kvass, and entrepreneurs believe it could be the UK's next trendy drink amid the rising popularity of fermented foods. So kvass, that's K-V-A-S-S, is a non-alcoholic drink made from old rye bread that is soaked in water and fermented with a small amount of sugar to create a rich malty drink with a sweet sour flavour. So widespread is this liquid bread in Eastern Europe and the Baltic that older generations often recall drinking more kvass than water in their youth. Anton Puzoyov, 32 years of age, is a founder of Quas Drinks, that's Q-U-A-S, based in Edinburgh, and that's the first company to manufacture and sell kvass in the UK. He's a scientist with a PhD in biological science, and he came up with the idea to bring kvass to the UK when stranded in his native Estonia during the pandemic. He's been a teetotaler since 2014. He realised the drink he had known since childhood could offer a solution to the limited options he encountered in the pub with fellow students in Edinburgh. He said, "It's only after I started experimenting and understanding the science behind kvass that I realised its product has so much potential in terms of health benefits." He points to the live bacteria for gut health and high fibre content. Since launching in 2021, he says sales have doubled and has picked up two great taste awards along the way. He thinks the moment is right for drinks like kvass, which offer health-conscious consumers alternatives to alcohol and highly processed food. He said people want something that is not just enjoyable and tasty, but delivers them other value. The numbers suggest he's onto something. The global market for fermented food products, including other drinks such as kefir or food like kimchi and sauerkraut, is expected to reach a value of at least $30 billion by 2030. So Anton Puzoyov hopes to take the Quas Drinks, his company, nationwide this year, rolling out his drinks in more shops as well as pubs and cafes. Since introducing a shelf-stable version recently. He says he's doubled the number of stockists, and yet it's still the image of the yellow barrels back home that remain his guiding principle. I've had so many people saying this tastes exactly what their grandma made or what they would drink on the streets 40 years ago. He says this just is what keeps me going. So that's an article, Fermenting a Revolution with Liquid Bread, a product called Kvass. Made, it's non-alcoholic, made from old rye bread, soaked in water and fermented with a small amount of sugar. And the company's Kvass drink, so keep your eye out and ears out for that. Liquid Lips by the Blue Tones, because we're talking about Fermenting a Revolution with Liquid Bread, a company called Kvass Drinks making Kvass. Of course, you're listening to Live Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live, 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning at 11 until 12. We should have our PG on the line. Good morning, PG.
Good morning.
Good morning. So, what's caught your eye in the science news this week, then?
Oh, so looking around at bits and pieces.
Oh, but, fancy.
As most people might have heard over time, my cat likes to get involved just as I'm about to go on.
Oh,
air.
Yes.
So, they've got their own sort of agenda in life, but luckily, I think they could also have got a key to a terrible sort of problem for us human beings, and that's the NHS do breast screening program that detected 20,000 cases of breast cancer last year. About 3 in 10 women didn't take up the offer of screening, with officials stressing that appointments can save lives. But some research has been done looking at cats. And the gene mutations that drive the development of breast cancer in cats are similar to those seen in people. So they've been comparing the DNA of these changes across species, and they think that could help to bolster understanding of how the environment influences cancer risk. So the study was published in the journal Science, and researchers analysed different tumour samples from almost 500 pet cats. And the team looked for about 1,000 cancer-linked genes in both tumours and healthy tissue, including 13 types of cat cancer. So during the DNA sequencing, they found the genetic changes that drive some cancer types in domestic cats were similar to those found in humans. So that included similarities between feline mammary cancers and human breast cancers. So mammary carcinomas, cancerous tumours that developed in the cells of the breast tissue, are common in an aggressive type of cancer found in cats. So the study also found that certain chemotherapy treatments were far more effective on cat mammary tumours with the gene mutation, although more research is needed on it. Researcher Professor Sven Rottenberg led the new study and said, having access to such a large set of donated tissues allowed us to assess the drug responses between tumour types in a way that hasn't been possible at this scale before. So cats could be helping to sort out some new treatments and new approaches to dealing with breast cancer.
Wow, that's an interesting one, Paul.
Yeah, and so I give him the benefit of the doubt now when he probably wanted to tell us.
Brilliant.
Then another part of humanity, I guess, is the great headline that caught my eye in the Eye paper was the huge movement forward in the area of constipation research, which I thought was a good byline. An article by Claire Wilson, who says that, forget fibre, a new cause of constipation has been developed, and it may be down to the presence of two bacteria in the gut. So we talked about gut biomes, and what it says is that a study is at an early stage, but it could point the way towards new treatments for constipation. And that's work by Professor Kinji Ono, as a geneticist at Nagoya University in Japan. And we're the first to have proved that bacterial constipation does exist, he said. So constipation is when people have infrequent bowel motions, typically twice a week or less. And normally we're told that eating fibre is going to help us. And we're supposed to have at least 30 grams a day from foods like beans, peas and wholemeal bread. And I'm going to get my tongue around these. What is it?
Oh, good luck, Paul.
Akkermansia municiphilia and Bacteroides sciaticomicron. Well, that's it. We can't say them, but apparently they do have a problem for a lot of us. And usual remedies have failed. As well as those with Parkinson's disease, who are often stricken by constipation as well. So a previous study by microbiologists at King's College London also found people who had more than one of the bacteria tended to have a slower passage of food through their bowels. What they're saying is that the presence of these two things show that the mucus lining of your gut has been attacked, and it's the mucus lining that helps a regular passage for your movements. And so it's a huge movement forward in the area of constipation research.
Wow. Well, you know, more. The linking gut biome to lots and lots of things, aren't they?
Yeah, absolutely. Mm. I think it's pretty fundamental. So I'll say that lots of bits and pieces. There's a piece about the Tower Mustard Guardians are in a bid to save a rare herb in London. And Tower Mustard is thought to survive in only 30 sites across England. So volunteers in London have been starting to grow Tower Mustard before replanting it around the city as part of the efforts to save the threatened species. So the initiative builds on a community-led citizen zoo project, including Hop of Hope, in which volunteers reared marsh grasshoppers from eggs at a time when releasing them at home before releasing them in the wetlands across Norfolk. So great thing, Citizen Zoo Project, looking to save species and keep a rare herb alive and kicking. So very good. I guess one of the other things that caught my eye is on a local front, Sheffield University. And I did look at some time ago, when I was kicking around with a bit of time on my hands, at potential ways to beat the housing crisis. And one of the things that I looked into was to use, at that time, steel-framed barn buildings. And they could be adapted to be quickly made into a three-bedroom family home. And I sort of dug deeper into that and came across a lot of the things that challenge house building. But one of the answers is to have sort of factory-made housing. And I think we've talked before about the prefabs that used to be in Sheffield, various places, and in fact, some are still around.
Yeah, there are.
And they were an answer after the war to quickly building replacement housing for stuff that had been damaged through the war and for the people returning from the war needing decent new housing. So a lot of plywood had been used in the war, and they used the skills and the people who'd been developing uses for that to basically fit out and develop these prefabricated homes. So Sheffield University have developed something in conjunction with the mayoral office for Yorkshire, South Yorkshire, and they've developed what they call a factory in a box. So they post something on the university site where you can watch a video as a home is built in 10 days using Sheffield's factory in a box to demonstrate a solution to the housing crisis. So they built this family home from scratch in all weathers in 10 days as University of Sheffield experts demonstrated this revolutionary idea of factory in a box. So there are large factories that build prefabricated housing, but generally the approach to that is to ship large panels that are used to fix together to create new housing. This approach really builds a covered area, a big arched sort of cover for the building space, and then the components made on site, a lot of it, so that they can construct it and make the final adjustments under cover, so it's all weather sort of capability is built into this approach. So they say by blending the precision of factory manufacturing with the flexibility of on-site builds, systems significantly reduce the logistical hurdles of time and costs compared to both traditional builds and off-site modular housing. So this trial has been funded by the South Yorkshire Mayoral Combined Authority, and it demonstrates a scalable solution to help UK government possibly achieve its building of 1.5 million new homes. So it's an interesting approach, and I think an interesting development with the support of the mayoral combined authority, looking at local things. And I did note from the council website that they've created two new communities along the old industrial strip out from the city out towards Meadow Hall. And they're going to be collating the development of the housing projects that are going to be built there on old factory sites, the brown sites that are there. So this approach could move across. It's built, it's put together in partnership with the Seismic Group, and system builds, they say, on this by transporting the kitted parts directly to the construction site, unlike the traditional off-site housing where they have to ship large prefabricated components from wherever the factories are, so quite distant locations, usually from where the builds are happening. So this actually creates that system on the locality where it's being built.
Wow, did they say, you know, the trial that the South Yorkshire Metal Combined Authority did, do you know where they built that? Did they just build it at the university, or was it actually...
They've not actually said,
no.
I think, but they do give you access to a video. It's, I think, in Runway Park is where the Innovation District is.
Oh, yeah, so the Advanced Manufacturing Park, that sort of area off the parkway somewhere.
Yeah.
Yes.
So, it's great, and I think, very laudable. But I think from my bit of research... when I was sort of looking at this, and that came from another sort of early initiative in Sheffield to try and use containers to build housing. And there were a couple of things before we had a bit of a debacle in the city centre of trying to build some shopping and facilities out of containers that didn't go particularly well. And it was one of the things I saw. The containers, yes, there's a fairly ready supply of containers available, but to actually convert them into viable housing rather than pre-accommodation is very difficult. So that's why I started to look at things like, these sort of farm buildings, barns that were actually a metal framework that shipped on site and then they were clad. Obviously not for accommodation, but then you can actually create these panels in a factory environment that could be fitted onto that. But then there's a stumbling block, and as usually you find, where are you going to put the housing? So you've got to have access to land. And in the UK, a lot of the big housing companies undertake what they call land banking. So they go and buy sites and sit on them until they feel that the market conditions are best for them to create something where they make more money. Again, one of the things I talked about is for individuals to get together. And there have been a couple of trials in Sheffield that I talked about. Gleadless Valley had some sort of self-built properties. And across on Freshville, there are a couple of rows of self-built properties where I used to live, not far from there. So that's available. And kind of my thoughts start to brew on, well, hang on a minute, we've got this huge unemployment problem with young people, we've got this huge housing shortage, skills deficit. So there has to be some thinking that says, well, okay, how about these young people who can't get the housing ladder being given support to do self-built housing for themselves? So when there are brownfield sites like in Sheffield, then something like this factory system could come in a very short space of time and develop built properties. But the other things that you've got to sort of look into is a lot of the value of housing is built on its longevity. And once you get these new approaches, there's not a track record. So banks and financial institutions don't particularly like to lend on them, and if they are lending on them, like to protect their investment and get some money back more quickly than on bricks and mortar. So it's one of those big problems where it's going to take a coordinated solution, and I think the actual elements to enable that being done are around. So money is going to be the biggest problem. And we've seen in Sheffield a lot of shared equity in new housing. So you actually buy 25% of your new home, but then you have to pay rent on the 75% of the property. You give them the ability to then progressively purchase more of that profit, so that people who found it difficult because of lending issues to get on the housing ladder are given a lower rung to access housing. But it comes at a cost because you pay a rent on the remainder. So it's still going to be a higher cost than the ability to take the old-fashioned mortgages in the numbers that they used to do forward. So that's the solution, I think, that has got to be included in something like this factory solution.
Interesting. What you say about lending money on stuff that's not as permanent as it were, or tested or anything, but there is some prefab houses still in Ecclesfield on Mill, I think it's Mill Road, and they're still going.
Up at High Green as well.
Yeah, so it is possible, isn't it?
Well, that's what I say. I think it was a huge government-backed programme post-war. And they knew they got to create housing for a lot of people, the troops returning from various theatres of the war, but also the damage that had been done to a lot of cities. We had the Sheffield Blitz, that did damage, and they built on some of those areas that were damaged by bombing that destroyed the old properties. But they took this route of a faster build. They were envisaged really as a quick response. But if you look at it, I mean, Vic Hallam houses were built on the system that they developed really for housing troops in the war. So the Nissen huts and things for temporary accommodation became that kind of housing. And we had things like prefabricated concrete slab builds. And again, on this southern side of the city, there are areas, people like the Coal Board used that construction method to build houses for their employees. And because they're non-standard construction, it creeps into the financial situation of being able to mortgage those properties. So quite often you see them up for sale for a cash-only price. So you've got to sort of look at that. But those properties have stood for 50, 60, 70 years. So how long do they become non-standard?
Well, this is it, isn't it?
Well, that's, as I say, the solutions are there, and I think this is a terrific sort of approach that's been taken by the university, because, again, weather's a significant factor. I mean, if you're looking at the pothole situation, then you find out that weather's a part of the problem being developed, but also a problem for being able to fix the problem, because if you've got rain like we've got, then it becomes very difficult to put a new surface down in those conditions.
Yeah, so they say. Fantastic stuff, Paul. We're going to have to let you go because we've got our Chris literally waiting in the wings.
I'm going to make the way because he's always got something to talk
about. He has. He was going to actually come into the studio, but he's not. We're going to call him. So all being well, it'll all go well. Great stuff, Paul. We'll speak to you Monday on Glory Days Rock Show, 1 till 3. Bye-bye, Paul. Bye.
Bye. Bye. Bye.
nice bit of Santana there for RPG, even though he's talking about housing, the housing crisis, and other things, all good stuff. You're listening to the Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire, or sheffieldlive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning, 11 until 12. We should have had Chris Dale on the line.
Hello.
Oh, good morning, Chris. Are you there?
Good morning.
You are.
Can you hear me okay?
We can indeed. I expected Paul to bring you in on some nice piece of music or something, but no, you're here straight away. And you sound loud and clear, Chris.
That's lovely. I just wanted to say that you mentioned, or Paul mentioned, seismic and the work that's happening with Sheffield University.
Yes.
I just wanted to say that I know the managing director of the Seismic Group. He's a really special individual, and I'm sure he'd love to talk to you all at some point in the future.
Wow, be fascinating. You see, our PG's always pretty hot, isn't he, on local news.
Amazing stuff.
Yeah, particularly talking about research and stuff done by the universities, both universities, Hallam and University of Sheffield, and of course the amazing Advanced Manufacturing Park. Good old Sheffield. But no, you're here to talk about something else, Chris. Thanks for joining us, as always.
I'm here to talk about Forever Chemicals.
Yes.
So another miserable 10 minutes from me.
Yeah, Mr. Doom.
Mr. Doom, I do apologise, but I think it's important that we talk about this. And it's also talking about Forever Chemicals also in the context of food as well.
So, go ahead.
So, Forever Chemicals, they're better known as PFAS, and that stands for per- and polyfluoroalkyl substances.
Well done.
And they are, thank you, they are a group of about 10,000 chemicals that have been used since the 1940s for their water, grease and heat resistant properties. They've been used in anything from waterproof clothing to cookware, electronics and even medical equipment. And they are persistent pollutants, meaning that they don't degrade easily and instead build up in the environment. They exist in our homes, our water, in our food, in our soil and in the air we breathe. PFAS chemicals don't break down, said a spokesman from the Royal Society of Chemistry. And according to Dr. Sabine Donai, who is a specialist in preventative healthcare, she says she has never met anyone without at least some PFAS in their bloodstream. And that's really worrying.
It is.
So once these chemicals get into our bodies, they stick around and build up little by little until they start to interfere with our systems. Some PFAS has been linked with thyroid problems, some to kidney and liver cancer, and some have been even shown to affect fertility. And very sadly, a woman's body can rid itself of some of these chemicals during pregnancy by passing it on to their babies. And that was the bit that really shocked me, because it just feels as though once they're there, you can never get rid of them.
Wow.
So how do PFAS chemicals enter our bodies? Well, our greatest exposure to forever chemicals comes from food, and that's particularly fish, meat, eggs, fruit and fruit products, according to the European Food Safety Authority. An innocent-looking strawberry could have PFAS exposure because the chemicals can be added to pesticides to help them stick better to the fruit, so when it rains, it doesn't wash off. So therefore, fruits such as grapes may have been exposed to these chemicals, and experts say that a bottle of wine could carry the greatest risk because we concentrate hundreds of grapes into each bottle. And as the wider pesticide breaks down, the PFSA bit is left behind for us to drink.
Oh, this is bad news, Chris.
Well, it's certainly bad news for you and Paul.
Well, we'll have to start buying organic.
Yeah, absolutely. But it just comes back to everything that we've been sort of discussing for the last sort of 3 or 4 years, that every time something is done that to cure one problem, so in this case, washing off pesticides, it then creates another problem elsewhere.
Yeah.
And we found that, haven't we, in just about everything that we've looked at. So clothing is also a way that PFAS can enter our bodies. Experts have identified that waterproof or stain-resistant clothing can contain these chemicals. Manufacturers are under no obligations to disclose this information. So some children's products and children's clothes, children's coats, children's waterproof coats are not PFAS free.
Wow.
And because they are made with forever chemicals. And an expert said, if fabrics containing these chemicals come into prolonged contact with human skin, there's the potential the chemicals can be absorbed across the skin. To reduce the risk, you should opt for untreated fabrics and avoid waterproof or stain repellent labels unless they say they are PFAS free.
My word, I can't say I've ever seen anything with that label that says it's free. Because there's a lot of waterproof garments, as you can imagine.
That's right, because obviously there's also been that sort of increase in people since COVID going out into the countryside and walking and climbing and that sort of thing. So I says there's been a growth in that area of clothing, hasn't there?
Mm, yeah.
So PFAS chemicals are so embedded in modern life that none of us can fully escape them. They have made our lives convenient and our products durable, but at a potential cost that we are now only beginning to count.
I was going to say, Chris, I was going to say, Chris, on that point, that doesn't that sound familiar? As in ultra-processed foods, it's the same thing over and over again, isn't it?
Yeah, that we make things convenient, we try to make things cheap, we deal with one problem, but actually we don't actually look at the long-term cost.
Yeah.
So the European Commission is currently consulting on an outright ban on all 10,000 chemicals. The UK government said it's looking to ban or restrict some of the chemicals, but has not committed to a blanket ban. The EU is working at pace with regulators to assess levels of PFAS in the environment, their sources and the potential risk to inform its approach to policy and regulation. And again, doesn't that tie in with what we've had with the food industry as well?
Yeah, well, yeah, and yeah.
Remember we had that discussion on e-numbers a few, and actually they realised that some of these e-numbers are doing damage and they're now going back to try and regulate those.
Yeah, it's frightening.
Right. Well, there is some good news, though, and I wanted to finish on a positive because I hate always coming on here and talking about bad things. But you can reduce the PFAS in your body, and it can take sort of 2 to 3 years to do so. So you can never get rid of them, but you can reduce them if you have a strategy. So experts are suggesting that you increase fiber intake. So either by eating more oats, barley, beans, nuts, seeds, or by taking supplements of gel-forming fiber. You also, so that's one way, is that by having higher fiber, that can then help release some of these PFAS out of your body. And actually, when you look at the oats, barley, beans, nuts, and seed, that's the diet that the indigenous Red Indians had in America. So we're going back to that sort of food. So you also need to identify the biggest sources of exposure in your home. So you may want to replace non-stick cookware with ceramic, stainless steel, or cast iron alternatives. You might want to use a water filter and switch to eco-friendly cleaning products, which are transparent about being PFAS-free. Any non-stick frying pans with scratches on them should be thrown out, because they are, once a frying pan has a scratch, it can get into your food. So they also say that buying a water filter can help reduce exposure. And that's like if you fill up a jug with a filter from the tap, or you install a filter into the actual sink. And then another way that you can manage this is that apparently carpets can be treated with these chemicals to make them more stain resistant, so that before you vacuum your carpets, make sure you ventilate the room by opening the windows, because these chemicals can collect as house dust and you can breathe them in when vacuuming.
Blimey.
So there's just some tips. There's an awful lot more I could have written about here, but I just wanted to sort of bring some of the highlights about what could happen. So I think you've already said this, Julie, but in conclusion, this is another example how a lack of research and regulation has impacted onto humans generally.
Yeah, what do we do about it? Because it's in great, it's everywhere, isn't it? It's like ultra-processed foods are everywhere. These fabrics and, you know, pesticides and everything are everywhere, aren't they?
And there's nothing that we can really do about it apart from maybe some of the things that I suggested just at the end of the end of the talk. But again, if you look at our exposure to, say, E numbers, the ingredients of ultra processed food, and then we've got these fluoroalkyl chemicals, it just sort of means that we're exposed no matter which way we go. And really, we need to start thinking about this sort of and how to deal with it very, very quickly. Otherwise, it's going to have a lasting impact on us humans and animals as well, of course.
Yeah, and it gets into the water, doesn't it, as well? The chemicals, if you wash your clothes, it's going to go down into the water course, isn't it?
Yep, if you think about the thousands and thousands and millions of people that wash their clothes every day and the water go, yeah, absolutely. So that was my presentation for today on the Life Science
Show. Excellent, Chris. There's a nice theme going through that, isn't there, though, about... and I just want to touch on the fact that people who've probably not got a lot of money, probably the more disadvantaged people, they're more likely to buy cheaper non-stick pans. We've all done it. You buy them for not a lot of money and straight away you scratch them, don't you?
Yeah, absolutely.
You know, so I think that's very interesting, you know, that if you maybe some of the more expensive pots and pans and clothing and wines and everything that's a bit more expensive may well be a bit more, you know, ethical or not have these chemicals in it, but you can't always afford that.
Yeah, absolutely. And it does impact on our most needy in society.
Yeah. Fantastic, Chris. So what topic are you going to do next? Out of interest.
Well, I haven't thought, but I might see if my colleague from Seismic might be able to come on in a month's time or so and talk about the work he's doing
with the house
building.
Oh, fantastic. I'm sure PG might even come into the studio for that one. Brilliant, right. Chris. Thank you very much for joining us, Chris.
Oh, and I've got a song as well.
Oh, you have? It's a cracking song, a cracking choice. Go on, do you want to say what it is?
It's Live Forever by Oasis.
Amazing. Thank you, Chris. Have a great weekend.
Thank you.
Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye.
Bye.
Maybe I don't really want to know how you got in grows, 'cause I just want to fly. The pain in the morning rain as it soaks you to the bone. Maybe I just wanna fly, wanna live but don't wanna die. Maybe I just wanna breathe, maybe I just don't believe. Maybe you're the same as me, we see things I'll never see. Maybe I don't really wanna know how you got it wrong, 'cause I just
Cracking choice of track there from our Chris. Live Forever by Oasis, of course. Brilliant, because he was talking about forever chemicals in our blood. All interesting stuff. Chris is our guest speaker every fourth Saturday of the month here on the Life Science Radio Show, Sheffield Live 93.2 FM on digital if you're in South Yorkshire. Or SheffieldLive.org, talking about science in all its different forms every Saturday morning from 11 until 12. We've just got a bit of time to talk about another article. So in the press, scientists hear hurt plants say ouch. And this was by Ben Spencer, science editor. Biologists have worked out how to listen to plants' distress calls, paving the way for farmers to be sent an alert when crops are attacked by pests and diseases. Scientists at Syngenta, an agricultural company, technology company based in Basel, Switzerland, have for the first time used machine learning to decode the electrical signals emitted by plants. And so far, the message that has come across most clearly is the equivalent of a plant dialing 999. So Patrick Hoger, who's head of the company's insect control research group, said, "It's a plant's way of saying, ouch, I'm being hurt." So botanists have known for more than a century that plants transmit electrophysiological signs between different parts of their structure. But until now, these signals, which travel through the ion currents in tissue channels that transport water, minerals and nutrients throughout a plant, have been meaningless to humans. By monitoring the electrical output from the plants and running it through their computer models, the team in experiments published in the Journal of Pest Science could spot the moment the plants came under attack. So that's scientists at Syngenta, an agricultural technology company in Basel, Switzerland, for the first time have used machine learning to decode electrical signals emitted by plants to know when they're in distress, to alert farmers that the crops are being attacked. Very interesting, eh? Track there from the one and only Mr. Bill Nelson. Don't touch me, I'm electric. And that's all about this company in Switzerland using electrical signals emitted by plants to detect when they are under threat. Thanks for listening to Life Science Radio Show here on Sheffield Live 93.2 FM. Join us next Saturday morning from 11 till 12. If you can't wait till then, join us Monday 1 till 3 for Glory Days Rock Show. Great rock music in all its different forms. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.